From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're watching two disasters unfold. Hurricane Maria is pounding Puerto Rico after landfall early today, one of the strongest hurricanes ever to hit the island. The governor urged people to have faith, saying, "We are stronger than any hurricane. Together we will rebuild." We'll have more on Maria, but we start the hour in Mexico City, where the search continues for people trapped under collapsed buildings after the 7.1 magnitude earthquake yesterday. This morning, a little girl's hand was spotted in the rubble of a school. When rescuers yelled for her to move it, she did. She was freed. Horribly, over 20 other children died when that building collapsed. Peter Orsi is a Mexico City correspondent with the AP. And Peter, we've been seeing these images, hearing reports like yours, of dentists and lawyers lined up with street sweepers and construction workers forming human chains, using bare hands to try to remove the rubble.
Yes, I was on the street last night and yesterday afternoon, and definitely saw that. In one instance, I saw people form a human chain that must have stretched for about five blocks along sort of a tree-lined avenue, around the corner, across a busy street, and into a public park where they were depositing buckets of debris and then also chunks of rubble itself. It's a scene that you've seen, that I've seen at least seven sites of collapsed buildings, anywhere from five to eight stories tall, lots of apartments. One thing that really struck me was also the neighbors who were rallying to help, people who were possibly inside these buildings. They were turning out in the hundreds at each of these sites, donating water and all sorts of supplies. In one place, I saw shopping carts being used to bring bottles of water into these collapse zones, and then those same shopping carts would be loaded up with rubble and brought right back out. The human chains, they set it up and they have everybody space out one arm's length apart. And so that sort of maximizes the reach, and they just it's just a continuous chain of passing buckets and rubble from one person to the other, and it also is pretty moving when you're at these sites and everybody's working so hard with sledgehammers and some heavy machinery, shovels, picks, buckets, people's own hands, and then all of a sudden, people will just call for silence, and everybody thrusts their hands in the air. And you know that that's when they're listening to hopefully hear voices of people trapped in the rubble.
Yeah, just quite something. Look, I'm sure the area is still in shock, but are officials coming forward, government leaders, to say, here's what we're doing, here's what's going to happen?
Yes, the president, the mayor, the interior secretary, the head of the National Civil Protection Agency, they've all been pretty front and center in media and on social media as well. At least in Mexico City, I know that there are no schools today. The metro, which is quite extensive, one of the most widely used in the world, is nearly up to full capacity. Almost all the stations are working. Power is beginning to come back in some of the neighborhoods that were left in darkness overnight. There's also a heavy police presence on the streets that you can see in both foot patrols and then also vehicles that are moving slowly along the streets. And I have to say, I've been living here for 12 years. There's practically no traffic at all. It's not like the city's at a standstill, but it's definitely in a mode where people are sort of taking stock and trying to figure out how a return to normalcy is going to look like.
And it's just so weird because, the citizenry had just staged a drill because this was the anniversary of the 1985 earthquake, which killed 10,000 people. Presumably structures weren't as strong back then, but, everybody has to be in such shock. Peter Orsi, a Mexico City correspondent for the AP, thanks so much for bringing that story to us. Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Well, in Washington, Republican leaders are trying one last time to repeal the Affordable Care Act. A quiet effort to find a replacement has been gaining steam, and leaders are hoping to bring a bill known as Graham-Cassidy to a vote next week. But opposition is also growing. The American Medical Association, the AARP, and other groups have come out against it, and at least 12 governors, including some Republicans, say they're opposed. Joining us now is Julie Rovner, chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Hi, Julie.
Hey, Jeremy.
And let's talk about the timing of this, first of all, because it looked like the effort to repeal and replace Obamacare had died back in July when that repeal bill fell one vote short in that dramatic late night vote. Why is the Senate attempting to revive this issue right now?
Well, that's right. And the reason we all thought it had died is because Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said it was dead. But he actually didn't. They didn't conclude work on that bill. He pulled it. So he always knew there was a chance it could come back. And what he said was, if we can find 50 votes for something, which is all that they all Republicans need to pass under these special budget provisions, that he would bring it back. Well, he's finding out that this bill is nearing. It is not there yet, but it is nearing 50 votes. And they have until September 30th to do this. That's when the fiscal year ends. And that's when their ability to do this with a bare majority, 50 votes plus the vice president, ends. So basically, they have until the end of next week.
After that, they would need 60 votes to do something.
Or they would have to do a new budget resolution that would allow them to do it again. But yes, after that, they would need 60 votes.
So let's talk about what the Graham-Cassidy bill would actually do. How is it different than the earlier Obamacare repeal efforts?
Well, in many ways, it's a bigger change from the status quo than some of the other proposals that Republicans have been talking about earlier in the year. It basically takes all of the money that the Affordable Care Act gave in premium subsidies and in the Medicaid expansion and in help for people with their out-of-pocket costs, and it bundles them into a big pot of money, and it redistributes it among the states. But it doesn't give the states what they get now. It would basically try to make up for the fact that 20 states didn't expand Medicaid. So it would give those states more, and it would give the states that did expand Medicaid less. So it would be a very big sort of redistribution of a whole lot of money. States could do with almost anything they want. They would be allowed to waive lots of the current Affordable Care Act requirements if they wanted to for insurance.
What would the bill mean for people with pre-existing conditions? Because that's gotten a lot of attention on social media from people who are opposed to it.
Yes, it has. And basically what it says is that the underlying law, because they can't repeal that through the budget process they're using, would remain. But states could, in fact, waive those requirements that people with pre-existing conditions not be charged more. The insurers would still have to cover them. And their sponsors are going around saying, well, nothing would change because states would still have to say how they were going to protect people with pre-existing conditions. But it doesn't really define that. So a lot of analysts have pointed out that, you know, states could set up a high risk pool that would only have 500 or 1,000 people in it, and everybody else would be on their own. So it basically would allow for people with pre-existing conditions to be discriminated against once again, as they were before the Affordable Care Act passed in 2010.
What would it mean for people who are currently on Medicaid?
That's not clear. It would take the funding for the expansion and put it into this pot of money. States could try to maintain both the expanded Medicaid and their underlying Medicaid populations, but they will be getting less money, substantially less money. We haven't seen anything from the Congressional Budget Office yet, but judging from how this is like other bills, we've seen estimates that this would take $215 billion out of the healthcare system between the years 2020 and 2026, that it would cut federal funding for healthcare by $4 trillion over the next two decades. So states would definitely have much less money to work with. Whether they can make that all up in efficiency seems unlikely.
And the headline number every time we've seen the reports from the Congressional Budget Office is how many people would lose their health coverage because of whatever bill we're talking about. But as you said, we haven't heard from the CBO on this one. Do we have any sense of how many people would lose coverage?
Well, there was an estimate out this morning from the Commonwealth Fund that said it would be 32 million people. That would be after 2026. I should point out that these block grants only last for 6 years and then they go away. The CBO said that they would come out with a preliminary score next week. They need something in order to go to the floor just to find out whether it conforms to the budget requirements. But they said they probably wouldn't be able to do an analysis of how many people would lose coverage by then. They would need significantly more time to do that. And as we mentioned at the top, they don't have any more time.
So there were three Republicans who voted against the last repeal effort. John McCain of Arizona, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, and Susan Collins of Maine. Have they given any indication how they might vote on this bill?
No, the only person who says that they are a no is Rand Paul of Kentucky, who says that he's been calling it Obamacare amnesty. Susan Collins certainly seems to be leaning that way, but she hasn't said yet. So the two people who are being watched most closely are John McCain and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. Those two both voted no to basically end the debate back in July. They are both playing their cards very close to the vest.
And even if this passes, it would still have to get through the House.
It would, but because of the way the budget process works, the House would have to pass it unchanged. It would be literally a take it or leave it proposition for the House.
That's Julie Robner, chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News, on the Graham Cassidy bill making its way through the Senate right now. Julie, thanks so much.
You're so welcome.
Author Dave Eggers has a new book out. It's a picture book for kids called Her Right Foot, about the Statue of Liberty. It tells the story of the building of the statue, but it also reminds kids of the Statue of Liberty's role in welcoming immigrants to the United States. Dave Eggers is also the author of several other books for adults, including the National Book Award-winning A Hologram for the King and The Circle, which explored a future in which one huge tech company launches a product where people can broadcast their entire lives online. The book was written before Facebook Live existed. But let's talk about the most recent book, Her Right Foot. Dave Eggers joins us from San Francisco. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And why did you want to do this book?
Well, it started a couple years ago when I was with my family and we were taking a ferry for some reason in the middle of winter. I think it was January, and we decided to take the ferry out to Liberty Island and see the Statue of Liberty. And honestly, I'd seen images of the Statue of Liberty, it has to be a million times over the course of my life, and I never had noticed until we were up close that she's in mid-stride and that she's seems to be walking and walking with great purpose out to the sea. And I thought, well, that's got to mean something. And from there, the rhetoric over the last few years about immigration has gotten very heated, and I thought it might be a good opportunity to remind ourselves who we are as a country and the role immigration plays and sort of why this statue that's walking out to sea might symbolize and remind us of immigration as a central point and tenet of who we are.
Well, I've been to the Statue of Liberty a number of times, and I must admit I didn't notice, or at least I don't remember noticing what you're talking about. Why did that stand out so much to you, that the statue is on the move?
I think it's a really apt symbol that the American experiment isn't one that is static. It's not like we have finished ourselves. It's not that the United States of America is done and we've settled exactly who we are forever. We are an ongoing experiment in democracy and in welcome, and welcoming the oppressed, welcoming the needy, welcoming people that want a better opportunity. And the fact that she's on the move, I think, is perfectly symbolic of that. She's not standing still.
Why do this as a book for children?
I've been around and working with kids for the last 16 years with 826 National, our network of writing and tutoring centers around the country. And so I've gotten to be, you know, working with kids on their stories and reading stories to them. And my kids now are young and they're readers. And so I've been steeped in picture books and children's literature for the last 15 years and wanting badly to write a book for young readers. And then this hit me and I thought, if anybody would understand this message and that it would resonate with them, I think it would be these young minds that are still, you know, being molded. And I think so many of our kids and the kids in the public schools in this country are from immigrant families. And so to remind them of our status and our foundation as a country of welcome, I think is powerful. And I've been able to read the book to a lot of classrooms and to see the sort of realization come over so many kids that not only should they be proud of their heritage and their parents and the journey that their parents made and the sacrifices their parents made to get here. But you see this sort of sense of pride coming up through them, this light in their eyes. And, you know, you see kids raising their hands, a lot of kids that didn't even know that their parents had come from elsewhere, that they were the sorts of people that the Statue of Liberty in this country was created to welcome. I think that there's nothing more fragile than a young person who doesn't feel welcome. And they can feel that so deeply, and it can, and it's so tragic when a young person whose parents gave up everything to bring them here does not feel at home in their new country. So we have to do everything we can to make these young people feel welcome, feel honored, feel wanted, and feel a necessary part of the American experiment, which is ongoing. So when you remind kids that the Statue of Liberty is not a static thing that stood for the country 100-odd years ago, but stands for it now and is walking, is striding out to sea to welcome the next wave of immigrants, they register that. You know, kids need to hear that.
Is part of the message of this book also, not just on the immigration issue, but also just a motivational message for young people that, you know, the Statue of Liberty is on the move, you should be too?
Yeah, I'm interested in teaching young people citizenship. I think that, you know, working with young people over these last 16 years at 826 National, they are so ready and so eager to be heard and to be active citizens, and they are just chomping at the bit. And if you give them an opportunity to become active citizens, to be heard or get their thoughts on paper, to speak, you know, truth to power, they will take that opportunity every single time. And I think that we just have to remind them of their role as citizens.
Well, you've got a lot of interesting facts in here that many people may not know about the Statue of Liberty, even if they know a lot about the Statue of Liberty, that it was originally brown, that it was assembled in France and stood there for a year, that Thomas Edison proposed having a giant record player so the statue could speak. Did you learn a lot of these facts as you were putting this book together?
I did. I had no idea that it stood above Paris for a year. And also that for a while there was a proposal that it would, you know, the sculptor Bartholdi, who designed the statue, was looking for a home for the Statue of Liberty, and it was not easy to find it. For a while there was an ongoing battle between Philadelphia, Boston, New York, to sort of who could raise the money to bring the Statue of Liberty to their state, their city. And finally, Joseph Pulitzer, through his newspaper, The World, held a contest or sort of a plea to citizens to donate money to make it possible to bring the statue and assemble it in New York.
Dave Eggers, while we have you, I have to ask you about something else, which is the first book of yours that I read, which was The Circle, which in a way seems to have come true. You know, at this point, we've got Facebook Live doing live videos that people can take around with them. I wonder just what you think about that at this point, how prescient that book was.
Well, it's, you know, some of the things started coming true that I thought were 10, 15 years off. They started coming true right as the book was being published, and things have been getting weirder ever since. But things do move a lot faster in technology than we could ever sort of predict or dream of. And so the number of things that I thought were almost impossible or pretty far off, there's too many to count. And it's and it seems to only be going one way. But I will say that there is some hope. I think that as many of the tech companies, I feel like are at least listening to demands for the respect for privacy. They are at least considering, I think, people's need to own their online personas, their personal data, things like that. But then we have things like the Equifax leak,
right,
which is a terrifying thing. Why is it that this privately held, opaque company that we have no control over and no say in, why is it that they have the right to all of this information about us, and that their security measures are so porous that they can leak all of these things out onto the internet? And it's symptomatic of all kinds of problems.
But is the present as scary as you thought it would be in that book?
No, I made it a little scarier. I was trying to scare myself to death. And so I had a lot of fun doing that, actually. But I do feel that most of the people that work in Silicon Valley are good people. And I think that they are idealists. And I think that it's just a matter of we need to have a common conversation about what is appropriate, what is ethical, and draw a boundary around that and, you know, make and enforce a digital bill of rights that we all agree on. And I think most of those companies would be happy to act within it. That's just my idealist point of view, but I do feel that that's the case.
You're not only a writer, but for many years you were an illustrator and graphic designer. Your artwork is getting an exhibition in San Francisco and is being published in a new book next month. Does your art feed your writing?
No, it is therapeutic. After a day of writing, especially if it's sort of intense or nonfiction, I go into drawing, and often drawing ridiculous pictures of animals with ludicrous sayings above them. And to me, it's a way to use a different part of my brain to wind down. It's very cathartic and meditative. And, you know, and then about 10 years ago, I started selling the drawings to Support Scholar Match, which is our college access organization here in the city. And people bought them, and the money went to Scholar Match, and it seemed like it was a nice little system. People get a goofy drawing or a goofy painting that they can put in their bathrooms, and it helps some kids go to college.
That's Dave Eggers, the author of many books. His latest book for kids is called Her Right Foot, about the Statue of Liberty. Dave Eggers, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And if you want to check out some of the illustrations from the book, go to hereandnow.org.
Maria is still moving across Puerto Rico as a Category 4 hurricane, the strongest storm to hammer the island in 80 years. Let's bring in reporter Miguel Santiago of Radio Universidad de Puerto Rico, the public radio station. We talked to him yesterday as Maria approached. You might have heard him earlier on Morning Edition. He's our on-the-ground guy. And Miguel, you're in a very strong building, but how does it feel?
It's incredible. My generation has never experienced a hurricane before. So seeing now firsthand, it's incredible just to witness. You know, winds were, you know, hitting the building pretty hard. You know, sometimes I would feel it shake a little. But yeah, that's how I've been handling the hurricane so far.
Well, shake a little, and it's a big, strong building. Do you have a sense of what's been happening?
This building has a generator. You can say I'm lucky because a big part of the island does not have electricity. But I can see how on social media people are, you know, of course, they're scared. They're in their homes or in a shelter just trying to get through this. One of the things I hear most about friends or colleagues is the really loud noises that the hurricane can cause. You know, a lot of trees have fallen here. Some rivers are about to, you know, and excuse my English, you know, when the water just comes out of the river.
They crest and overflow.
Yeah. And one of the things that I've been told frequently is that a lot of water has been filtered in the houses. I just received a call from my aunt. We're getting water from the roof. Here in the newsroom, we're getting a lot of water in. So trying also to just try to maintain as little water as possible from getting in.
Yeah. Look, you're sort of on the tail end of this. And as a result, you probably know less about it, even though you're there, you know, than people watching some of the images that are coming on CNN, for instance, on cameras, because in a way you get isolated and cut off. Do you worry about what you're going to see when you do go out?
I do. I really am worried. I don't know how much Puerto Rico is going to take to, you know, reestablish itself for the whole island to have electricity or even water. So I believe it's going to take a lot of time to get back to normal.
Well, life-threatening winds apparently could continue for 12 to 24 hours.
That
so
is correct, yes.
You really can't get out to see what's going on. And, of course, Puerto Rico was on its knees, so to speak, not just from Irma, but from the bankruptcy, billions in debt, negotiations over that.
Correct. It's, you know, normally on the news we get a lot of politics, but, you know, all I see on the media is just hurricanes, and it's our biggest concern right now is how to handle this situation. You know, we've talked to heads of, you know, organizations such as agriculture. Of course, agriculture is going to take a big hit economically and just completely. while the whole island is being affected by the hurricane, some parts have it harder than others. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to make contact with the island municipality of Culebra and Vieques. Those are little islands to the east of Puerto Rico that belong to Puerto Rico. They're mm-hmm. right now they're one of the most affected by the hurricane, so they have practically no communication with the outside world. Mm-hmm. It's impossible to talk to anyone, and this was a region that was really affected by Irma. You know, practically the whole island wasn't as affected as Vieques and Culebra.
Yeah. Well, Miguel, there you are, writing out Maria. Miguel Santiago, Radio Universidad de Puerto Rico, there in San Juan, the public radio station there. Miguel, thanks so much for being our eyes and ears for a while now. Thank you.
Of course, thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, best to you.
It is unclear whether former White House chief strategist Steve Bannon and conservative provocateur Ann Coulter will appear in Berkeley, California next week at what's being called Free Speech Week. The list of speakers provided by the university doesn't include Coulter or Bannon, but a list provided by the organizers of the event, a conservative student group, does include them. Joining us now is John Sepulvedo, host of KQED's California Report. Hi, John.
Hi, Jeremy.
And clear this up for us. Do we know if Coulter and Bannon are going to speak?
No, if I could clear that up, I think everybody in the Bay Area would want to talk to me right away because it is part of the MO of these activities that have been going on in Berkeley to be as confusing and disorienting as possible. So we are hearing that Bannon will be there. We're hearing that Bannon will not be there. We're hearing that Ann Coulter is going to be here. We're hearing that Ann Coulter is not going to be here. And that has, again, just been part of the whole chaos that has always preceded these events. It happened just a few weeks ago. We heard for a moment that Ben Shapiro, a former Breitbart editor, was not going to speak at Berkeley. Then he might speak at Berkeley, but it was going to be something smaller. And then ultimately he was able to give an event that went very successfully. So it's just part of the MO of these groups to, A, partially because they're disorganized, but also partially because the anxiety that's generated by this is part of the desired affect of this movement.
Well, tell us more about the group, the student group, the Berkeley Patriot that's behind this, that's planning the Free Speech Week. Who are they and what do they want to accomplish?
So Berkeley Patriot is a newspaper that's conservative in nature, and it's been around since at least 2012. It might have been – there have been some semblance of it perhaps around the rise of the Tea Party back in 2010. And it's gone through a couple different incarnations, but this particular one, Berkeley Patriot. So in order to speak at Berkeley, you have to be invited by either the campus or, you know, some type of faculty group or a student group. And in this instance, Berkeley Patriot is essentially acting as the impetus to ask these folks to come to campus. Berkeley Patriot is not paying the speaker fees or the event fees, as much as $70,000, they've told me. They are not really kind of leading a lot of the organization. And in fact, we saw that when Milo Yiannopoulos, the conservative provocateur, released a press release on his own accord saying that, you know, there were going to be people there who it turned out had never confirmed to anyone that they were going to be there. So Berkeley Patriot essentially is in one part a very small conservative group on campus that puts out a paper. But in the larger context of this is really kind of acting as the shell corporation to get these groups access to the Berkeley campus.
Well, actually, Yiannopoulos posted a YouTube video this week saying the university is using slippery bureaucratic tactics to try to prevent the event from happening. Here he is.
The administrators at UC Berkeley have tried everything to derail Free Speech Week, up to and including accusing the students of being inept. They're not.
Has the university tried to cancel Free Speech Week, as he says there, or what's been the reaction to the event?
I think the university has said these are the rules, and we are going to enforce the rules and be very clear about that. That's not to say that the university hasn't really looked to be a stickler for the rules. But this idea that there are really two ideas here that are interesting and worth exploring. The first is that, you know, Berkeley is throwing up a bunch of bureaucratic stuff. What the University of Berkeley is citing is very clear. It's the rules for any group. And Berkeley Patriot has confirmed to me that at points they said that they didn't look like they had their act together because they were saying one thing and then doing another. And then Milo Yiannopoulos puts out a press release and then they have to retract it. Again, that's part of the chaos of this event. The other aspect of this is that there is a lot of money. And I want to just point this out. Milo Yiannopoulos is talking about free speech. There is a lot of money that's being spent to secure the events that are on campus, some $70,000, not to mention other security costs, not to mention other fees. And we don't know where that money is coming from. So on one hand, while we're saying that this is a free speech event, what this is a bot speech event. And I think that's important to note as he talks about these things.
Why has Berkeley, which is probably one of the most liberal cities in America, become a center of right-wing speech?
Well, it's not right-wing speech, I would say. I think it's far-right speech, and it's become a center of far-right speech because the far-right has taken the tactic, and Milo Yiannopoulos, you know, being the prime example, of essentially trolling people who wouldn't want to hear it, and that's what this is. When I talked to Berkeley Patriot, and I said, you know, what is the academic value of having Ann Coulter or Milo Yiannopoulos speak on campus?
Right.
They say there isn't any. They are the first to acknowledge that there's no academic value. That's not the case with Steve Bannon, who, of course, served in the White House and has a very unique perspective and look. But Pamela Geller, one of the people who's coming there, this is somebody who has spent her career, you know, baiting people and getting people to react. So that's the reason that it's happening here. It's essentially a big bait.
It's John Sepulvedo at KQED. John, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, for weeks, swaths of the country have been getting hit with hurricanes and wildfires, and that's having an impact on the economy. New reports on the housing market show signs of temporary stress tied to weather troubles. But for the longer term, housing may be looking up because younger Americans are jumping into ownership. Let's hear about the latest reports with NPR senior business editor Marilyn Giewax. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi, Robin.
And start with the weather. There was Hurricane Harvey hitting Texas and Louisiana. Irma slammed into Florida in the south. Now Puerto Rico getting battered by Maria. This has to be having an impact on the economy.
No, it really is. It's hurting. And of course, there's always a temporary bump up from a storm. That is, people have to spend money to clean up. You know, they're chopping down trees or buying new carpets, food to restock your refrigerator. But on balance, you know, you never hear an economist saying, hey, let's all burn our houses down because that'd be good for the economy. You know, that is not how it works. There's a temporary burst of spending, but overall, you lose a lot. You have lost work hours, lost capital stock, your reduced savings, all kinds of problems. And I've seen different estimates, but it looks like Harvey and Irma may have cost something like $150 billion in gross losses. Yeah. So on balance, these big weather events and the wildfires, they're hurting the economy in general, but in particular, they've had a really bad impact on the housing sector. And we've had three different reports over the last 3 days that all show that.
Tell us about those reports.
Well, the National Association of Home Builders survey showed that there was this big drop in optimism. Now, you'd think that maybe builders would be cheerful because there's all these houses to rebuild in Texas and Florida. But okay, maybe in a few specific markets that's true, but nationwide, it's driving up the cost of building materials and it's making the labor shortages worse, so profits are hurting. And a lot of these storms caused activity to come to a halt.
Right.
So there was a second report from the Commerce Department that showed new home completions, that is just finishing it up and getting the sale done. They were down 22% in the South. Mm. So if you're a builder, if you can't finish the project because the wind's howling, you're not making your profit.
What about realtors? You know, Houston in particular is such a hot market. What's happening?
Well, that's that third report. Just this morning, the National Association of Realtors said existing home sales fell by 1.7% from July. Part of that is because there's not enough inventory in some parts of the country, but a lot of it was because of that hurricane. Some people just couldn't get to the closing for their home sales. You know, the weather was really tough. So you're talking about short-term problems that are hurting, and especially think about Texas, Florida. Those are really big housing markets. But, you know, to be fair, when you step back and you look at the really big picture, actually economists are pretty excited about housing because the job market's strong, interest rates are still really low, and most of all, drum roll, millennials, welcome to the housing market. They're really starting to buy houses.
Wait, we thought millennials, people in their 20s to mid-30s, wanted to be urban hipsters.
Yes, they did want to be urban hipsters until they got enough money to buy a house. So now they're moving into their 30s now, and they're having kids, and they want a house. And most of all, they want a house in the suburbs. So Zillow, National Association of Realtors, you look at their statistics, and it shows that millennials are by far the biggest group of home purchasers, and they want to live out in the suburbs. So bottom line is the recent storms, these fires, they have disrupted the housing market. But longer term, this is going to bounce back because we've got all those millions of millennials who want to buy houses.
Okay. NPR Senior Business Editor Marilyn G. Wax. Marilyn, thanks as always.
Oh, you're welcome, Robin.
The Washington Post is reporting that the Trump administration is seeking a permit to allow new assessments of oil in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. The move was immediately condemned by environmental groups. ANWR, as it's called, is the country's largest wildlife refuge, and proposals to drill there have been controversial. The Trump administration is also eyeing another chunk of federal land just to the west of the refuge, the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. This vast, remote area may not be as well known as the Arctic Refuge, but conservation groups say parts of the reserve are equally worth protecting. Elizabeth Harbaugh from Alaska's Energy Desk has this story.
Today, Melanie Smith with Audubon Alaska is teaching me a little bird language.
I think he's saying, stay away from my nest. So this is the yodel call of a yellow-billed loon.
Unfortunately, Smith and I are not birdwatching out in the wilderness. We're listening to recordings in her Anchorage office. That's because the place we're talking about, where we might find a nesting yellow-billed loon and many other bird species from all over the world, is over 600 miles to the north. It's a remote, Indiana-sized federal expanse of Arctic tundra and wetlands called the National Petroleum Reserve Alaska, or NPRA.
It's a somewhat unfortunate name, actually, Petroleum Reserve.
In the 1920s, President Warren G. Harding set aside NPRA specifically for its oil potential. Today, the federal government manages the petroleum reserve as a multiple-use area, a place with room for both habitat and oil drilling. That's different from the nearby Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which, barring an act of Congress, is completely off-limits to oil development. So Smith says for a long time, environmental groups focused on protecting the Arctic Refuge.
That's why it took longer to discover just how important and influential and irreplaceable parts of the petroleum reserve are, and really realize that they are on par with the Arctic Refuge.
Smith says a giant lake in the northeast corner of the reserve, called Teshikbik Lake, is a globally significant area for hundreds of thousands of migratory birds. That's why, in 2013, the Obama administration put close to half the reserve off limits to oil and gas leasing, including more than 3 million acres surrounding Teshikbik Lake. But that was then.
So the president has declared, and thank you, Donald J. Trump, that the war on North American energy is now over.
That's Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke at an oil and gas conference in Anchorage this May. He was in town to sign an order that, among other things, requires a review of the Obama administration's plan for managing NPRA.
This order, in effect, makes Alaska open for business.
It wasn't clear exactly what that meant until last month, when the Interior Department sent out a call to energy producers and the public asking which parts of the reserve should be opened up to oil drilling. Environmental groups were alarmed because the request made it clear that areas the Obama administration protected could be back on the table. But the move didn't come out of nowhere. Andy Mack is head of Alaska's Department of Natural Resources. He says reevaluating the plan makes sense because we know things now we didn't know 4 years ago.
It couldn't be a more dramatic shift.
It turns out there's probably a lot more oil in the reserve than everyone thought. 4 years ago, the Obama administration estimated there was less than 1 billion barrels of recoverable oil in NPRA. But over the last year or so, oil companies have found well over triple that amount in and around the reserve. Max says the promise of NPRA is a big deal for a state grappling with both a recession and a decline in oil production over the last few decades.
This is certainly some of the most exciting well results that we've seen, and it really is something that we as a state have to appreciate and understand and capitalize on.
The discoveries come on the heels of the first ever oil development in NPRA, a drill site run by ConocoPhillips. That started producing oil in 2015, and two more are on the way. And this could be just the beginning, according to Dave Hausnecht, one of the U.S. Geological Survey's top experts on Alaska's oil resources.
There's a lot of potential in all of northeastern NPRA for the kind of discoveries that have just been announced.
But it just so happens that the area with the most oil potential overlaps with the same area that environmentalists say is crucial wildlife habitat. Nicole Whittington Evans with the Wilderness Society says the recent oil finds, plus the Trump administration's order opening Alaska for business, have groups like hers on high alert.
We have a strong desire to see this area protected, and we are very concerned about the recent finds and the level of interest in drilling for oil in this extremely important place.
If the Trump administration moves to allow oil exploration near NPRA's Teshikbik Lake, environmental groups say they will fight it, just as they fought development in the Arctic Refuge for decades. The question is, will a place called a petroleum reserve capture hearts and minds as easily as the Arctic Refuge? For Here and Now, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
And we'll follow this story to see what the answer to that question is. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.